This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The fighting is definitely intensifying in Gaza. And Israeli troops are at the gates of the Shifa Hospital.
That's reporter Linda Grantstein in Jerusalem on the latest developments in the Hamas-Israeli conflict. Details coming up also. Liberia prepares for its runoff presidential elections tomorrow. And internally displaced persons or IDPs in Abuja, Nigeria, accuse the government of abandoning them. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Intensive fighting continues in the Gaza Strip. And aid organizations say hospitals in northern Gaza are seeing battles nearby. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warned today its operations in war-torn Gaza would shut down within 2 days due to fuel shortages as fighting rages between Israel and Hamas. Thomas White, the head of the agency known as UNRDWA, also said it had no fuel for trucks to ferry aid from Egypt into Gaza communities. Israel has blocked fuel from entering Gaza since October 7th, when Hamas militants stormed across the border and killed about 1,400 people and kidnapped some 240 others. Israel then began a bombing campaign that has killed more than 11,000 people in Gaza, mostly civilians, and cut off supplies of water, electricity, fuel, and food to the territory of 2.4 million people. Earlier, I spoke with journalist Linda Grantstein in Jerusalem. One topic is the concerns about Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, where there has been heavy fighting. Hospital officials say basically can no longer operate. Israel says it is not targeting medical facilities, but says that Hamas fighters often hide their operation facilities and troops near them. Hamas denies the allegations. So how are things where you are today as well as over the weekend?
Well, in Jerusalem, things are quiet, but the fighting is definitely intensifying in Gaza. And Israeli troops are at the gates of the Shifa Hospital. And the staff there says that they are really fighting to keep the newborn babies alive. And some of them, babies that had been in incubators, they took them out, wrapped them in foil, and put hot water next to them. That's according to the director of the medical center telling Al Arabi television. So the situation is very difficult in Gaza. At the same time, Israel says that there was firing on Israeli troops from another hospital, from the Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City, and that they opened fire on troops and that they were embedded within a group of civilians at the entrance to the hospital. So that just shows you sort of some of the complications of this situation. In Al-Shifa Hospital, which you spoke about earlier, there are believed to be about 7,000 displaced people and another 1,500 patients and medical staff.
And Linda, there are rising concerns about, you know, the fighting near Gaza hospitals and about shortages of fuel and supplies in hospitals. We've talked about the fuel shortage.
Yes. Now, Israel says that Hamas has plenty of fuel and has been, you know, hoarding fuel. Israel also released a video showing soldiers bringing 300 liters of fuel and leaving it right at the entrance to the Shifa Hospital. The hospital workers say that, first of all, they were too scared to go outside and get it, and they said that that's only enough to power the hospital for half an hour. So there's, again, debates about this. Israel also says that it's opened a humanitarian corridor from the hospital to allow anybody who wants to leave to be able to flee to the south, where there is more humanitarian aid, there is water, there is food, but there's, you know, any UN shelters are completely overrun. And in addition, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees called UNRWA just said that it will have to shut down its operations in Gaza within 2 days because of fuel shortages. And there are hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza who are sheltering in UN facilities like schools.
Israel has said it will pause fighting for several hours a day to allow people to flee northern Gaza and aid to reach those who cannot leave. What is the status of those pauses? Have they been happening?
As far as I know, they have not been happening as in terms of a complete cessation of fighting. Israel has said that there are corridors that they've opened up to allow people who want to flee from the north to the south, and tens of thousands of people have taken advantage of those corridors in the last few days. And so now the situation is that most Palestinians, most of the 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza are in the south of the country, but there simply are not the facilities to absorb them. And people who are sheltering in schools and places like that talk of terribly overcrowded conditions, you know, 4 toilets for 1,000 people, things like that. They're worried about the spread of disease and other problems.
And lastly, as condemnation of the conflict has grown around the world, stoking anti-Israeli sentiment, what is the Israeli government doing about that, reversing that mindset?
Well, in fact, the Israel's foreign minister today said that diplomatic pressure is beginning to increase, and he thinks that Israel only has another 2 to 3 weeks before the pressure gets very intense. I think Israel has sort of launched a campaign of releasing more information and more videos to show, that to sort of prove that their claims are correct. So, for example, today they said they found all of these munitions on the floor of the sea that Hamas had been using. Hamas came in the October 7th massacre by the sea, by the land, and by the air. And so they released a video of the Navy divers bringing these things up. They released a video of what they said was a Palestinian with an RPG shooting from the entrance of the Al-Quds hospital at troops. So I think they're trying to release more information, even some of it perhaps classified, as a way of trying to fight some of these allegations. Interestingly, the European Union, which often is very critical of Israel, today issued a statement criticizing Hamas for using civilians as human shields.
Linda Gradstein on the latest from Jerusalem. Thank you for your input, Linda.
Thank you.
The trial in Abuja of a journalist charged under Nigeria's Cyber Crime Act is coming under criticism from media advocates. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
At Nigeria's Federal High Court in Abuja, hearings in the case of journalist Saint Miampamo Onisha are underway. The founder of the online broadcaster Niger Live TV is accused of cyber stalking and defamation. Police arrested Miampamo in his hometown in Bayelsa State early last month, and the journalist remains in custody. Authorities say the journalist in September deliberately published a false and unverified report on Facebook, accusing officials of the Presidential Amnesty Program, or PAP, of beating a beneficiary to death. The PAP is a government-sponsored scheme that offers monthly stipends to former oil militants as part of efforts to end violence in the Niger Delta. Officials deny that anyone was killed. They say that when a beneficiary tried to force his way into the office, security resisted him. The person went to a hospital and was later discharged. Anande Terungwa is a lawyer representing Miampamo. He says that the journalist has pleaded not guilty and that he removed his report, published a corrected story, and issued an apology. Terungwa, who visited Miampamo in jail Monday, told VOA he suspects the case may be politically motivated. The journalist covers the amnesty program, unrest in Niger Delta, and in 2020 faced legal action over his coronavirus coverage.
They have been turning us around, playing politics. He was charged with 3-count charge, actually. Many people have published something related to that. So how many people have they arrested? How many people have they tried? How many people they just singled him out.
Nigeria's Justice Ministry did not respond to VOA's request for comment. Nigerian lawmakers enacted the cybercrime law in 2015 to protect its economy and prevent fraud and cyber attacks. But analysts say the legislation is used too often by authorities to prosecute journalists and that Nigerian media are often targeted with arrest and legal cases over their work. The Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, has repeatedly documented the use of Nigeria's Cyber Crimes Act to prosecute journalists. Jonathan Rosen is a senior researcher at the New York-based nonprofit.
We're constantly keeping track of attacks on the press, jailing of journalists, killing of journalists, surveillance, laws that are going to inhibit the press. We're constantly keeping track of those incidents and reporting them, documenting them, to provide an evidence base for our advocacy with governments. The Cybercrime Act and legislation around criminal defamation in Nigeria have been used repeatedly to jail journalists, to arrest journalists in connection with their work.
CPJ is calling for the swift release of the journalists and for reform, says Rosen.
We have called consistently, of course, along for the release of journalists that are jailed using this legislation, for Nigerian lawmakers, leadership in Nigeria, to reform these laws to ensure that the press do not have to worry about being jailed in connection with their work, to ensure that these tools that are used to criminalize journalism are not available in Nigeria.
Miampamo is back in court on December 4th. If convicted, he faces up to 10 years in prison or a fine of more than $32,000. For now, his lawyer says the priority is to get Miampamo out of jail. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Internally displaced persons, or IDPs, in Abuja, Nigeria, accuse the government of abandoning them, saying they lack portable water, toilets, clinics, food, and schools. Our reporter in Abuja has more after visiting IDP camps.
Internally displaced persons settled in camps in Abuja say they still lack the most basic amenities a full 10 years after the camps were established. Most of the displaced people are from Yobe, Borno, and Adamawa states. They fled violence from the Boko Haram insurgents. Many say they struggle to have enough to eat daily. Liatu Ayuba is the women leader at the IDP camp in the Durumi district and the coordinator for 18 camps. She tells VOA they only hear promises from government officials and agencies without action.
We are telling them that we people, we have tired.
Ayuba says they have been telling officials they are tired of the way they are treated, sitting in the camp day after day with no help from the government. She says the government should find an area or city where they can leave and start a new life. At the Durumi camp, women sit on the floor of an abandoned clinic while children clad in dirty and torn oversized clothes run about. Some men have gone out to find work, but the older men sit under a big tree. The people at the camp say health conditions are worsening because of the unhygienic environment and lack of portable water. They say they are refused treatment in hospitals because they don't have the money to pay or don't have authorization letters from the government agencies responsible for displaced persons. A volunteer and nurse at the Area 1 camp in Abuja, Issa Umar, spoke to VOA about the situation. He said the lack of adequate food and water means malnutrition, malaria, typhoid, and other diseases are common.
So the time when I came back from Gozha to...
When he started from Gozha, Borno State, he discovered his people in the camp needed help with their health issues as there were no drugs or hospital for them. Omar says that's why he volunteered to help them. He sees them complaining of cough, diarrhea, fever, and so on, and he tells them what drugs to buy outside.
To buy it outside.
Omar says the camps survive mostly on support from individuals, non-governmental organizations, and religious bodies. Emmanuel Onwubiko, the national coordinator of the Human Rights Writers Association of Nigeria, says it is time the government addresses the concern of IDPs.
IDPs are actually citizens of this country who, by no fault of theirs, have found themselves as internally displaced persons, and largely government is responsible for their plight. The primary duty of government, according to Section 14.2b, is to ensure that there is security of life and property in the country, and the government has failed.
The Federal Capital Territory Administration, which manages Abuja City, denied the allegations over neglect. They would not comment directly, but pointed out the policy that mandates that IDPs be protected. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Officials and activists from around the world this week aim to outline measures to end plastic pollution, which is piling up all over the world. Kenya is hosting the third session of the Intergovernmental Negotiation Committee on Plastic Pollution to develop a binding international treaty to remedy the problem. James Shimanyula has more from Nairobi.
The Nairobi Conference on Plastic Pollution comes nearly 9 months after the United Nations Environment Assembly decided on a mandate to create the world's first plastics treaty, a legally binding agreement on plastic waste throughout the world. One of the delegates at the conference is South Korean Simi Ri, policy advisor to Break Free from Plastic, a global movement working to end the problem.
The main goal is that no human or the environment or the biodiversity should be living in plastic pollution, to make sure that we could truly say that we can regulate and manage pollution on a global scale so that no one becomes victimized from plastics. That is what we should be achieving, and that is what the member states should really be striving for.
Rahyang Nusantara, coordinator of Alliance Zero Waste Indonesia, an alliance of 10 environmental organizations in the Southeast Asian nation, agrees.
The main goal is to discuss more about the zero draft. We need a strong treaty agreed by all of the member states to stop ending the plastic pollution. We need more upstream efforts to stop the production because recycling is not working.
The United Nations Environment Program, the UNEP, is hosting the Plastics Summit at its Nairobi headquarters. The UNEP says about 400 million metric tons of plastic is produced each year and less than 10% is recycled. Most winds up in landfills, rivers, and the ocean. Ree, with the Break Free from Plastic, talks about the hope activists have for the week-long conference.
What we want to see would be that the member states have a full read-through of the zero draft so that we could actually do negotiation going forward, and also to make sure that we have a mandate for some of those priority areas that do require deep thinking and much more high-level technical discussions. For instance, talking about what are the production reduction targets we're aiming for here under this treaty.
The zero draft is a document listing possible policies and actions that will be considered to part of a legally binding treaty by the end of 2024. Dozens of countries have imposed bans on plastic bags and some single-use plastics. Rwanda in Central Africa has one of the strongest bans, with most bags and single-use plastics outlawed, although it grants exceptions for some products, such as medical goods, waste collection bags, and some industrial uses. For VOA Africa, I'm James Shimanyula in Nairobi, Kenya.
Some HIV activists say confusion around funding for the United States' biggest global health program is endangering the well-being of many Africans living with the disease. The U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, was established 2 decades ago by George W. Bush to address the HIV epidemic. Now, political wrangling in Washington means funding for PEPFAR is uncertain. Darren Taylor reports.
Since 2003, the U.S. government, through PEPFAR, says it's given more than $100 billion to governments, universities and non-profit groups in 50 countries, saving 25 million lives and preventing millions of HIV infections.
It's absolutely essential. If you look at the difference that they've made in diagnostics, in supplying medicine, and the impact they've had on supplying essential medicines such as HIV and antiretrovirals in Africa, it can't be overstated the impact that PEPFAR has.
Michael Meinhardt is a public health specialist at the Avacare Global Group, a South Africa-based healthcare provider and medical research company. He told VOA, much of PEPFAR money's been used to provide antiretroviral or ARV medication to HIV-infected people. He credits the program with saving millions of lives in Africa, the continent worst affected by HIV. One of those people is Paula Majodina in Johannesburg. She says 15 years ago, she was ready to die.
I had TB, I had pneumonia. At some point, I was in a wheelchair. At some point, I couldn't feed myself. And I genuinely then, at that point, accepted that I'm living with HIV because of how I looked and what I was going through for the 6 months. And that is what then got me to eventually accept that I'm living with the virus and I have to take the medication so that I can live a longer life.
But going forward, Majodina's not sure she'll be getting a regular supply of ARVs. Her local clinic usually gets the drugs courtesy of PEPFAR. But refunding of the program hit a snag during a debate in Congress in late September. Republican chair of the House Global Health Subcommittee, Chris Smith, accused President Joe Biden's Democratic administration of abusing the program.
I strongly supported PEPFAR when it was created in 2003. And I was the sponsor of the reauthorization of PEPFAR in 2018. Regrettably, it has been reimagined, hijacked by the Biden administration to empower pro-abortion international NGOs, deviating from its life-affirming work. It's time we got back to the original noble idea. And that noble goal is to prevent this devastating disease, robustly treat and assist those who have been infected, not supporting abortion, the killing of unborn children by dismemberment.
Republican politicians have refused to approve a 5-year comprehensive spending bill for PEPFAR unless rules prevent funds from being used to cover abortion services. The Biden administration says PEPFAR money's never been used to promote or fund abortion. Under 1973 law, no U.S. aid money can be used to provide abortion services. However, some Republicans say that language in Biden's policy allows PEPFAR money to go to organizations that use funds obtained elsewhere to provide abortion care. Republican lawmakers want that changed. For now, PEPFAR remains partly funded only for the next year. Some Republicans have indicated they'll approve 1 year of funding for now. Meinhardt says the uncertainty around PEPFAR should spur Africa into taking action to make it less reliant on the U.S. to combat HIV.
We need to start thinking of the medium and long-term solutions and how do we create and develop self-sustainable funding models within a continent like Africa. So elements like local manufacturing, building infrastructure, becoming less reliant on importing medicines from international territories. You have to look at offtake agreements from public procurement agencies, from the government primarily, that's handing out these medicines, typically free of charge. You have to look at technology transfers. You have to look at skills development, IP development.
But for now, says South African HIV scientist Francois Venter, The political dispute over PEPFAR is playing with the lives of millions of Africans. He says if PEPFAR isn't funded in five-year cycles, its planning will be thrown into disarray, and there'll be delays in sourcing condoms and ARV medicine. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.